This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
So let's begin with a question that you addressed somewhat last night, but it's the idea that how did this start? How did you really do this? You were an academic, an epidemiologist, PhD in epidemiology. You had your master's in public health, but there's this newsletter that was terrific.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredibly organic. It was never planned. I think I said last night, whoever was here, it may be a little repetitive, but At first, my dean came to me at the School of Public Health and was like, "Caitlin, can you just try to explain to people what's going on?" I used to work at the WHO in Geneva, was looking at the data. She knew I was. I also just loved teaching. Like, teaching, it was just my my love of the world and my academic position. And so I did. I just wrote this email to faculty, staff, and students, a couple sentences long, really ugly Excel graphs, and just trying to explain what I was looking at, bring them along for the scientific discovery ride and what I was doing. And I signed those emails in the beginning, "Love your local epidemiologist," because that's who I was to them. And I really cared that people started understanding what was going on. And then it grew. And I stumbled upon this gap that I never thought we would all stumble upon. But people really needed timely, understandable, and actionable information, even based in uncertainty. And it was an incredible honor, and it still is. And now I land in a lot of people's inboxes right next to their bank statements. And like I said, it's an incredible honor.
You signed all of those love, YLE. And the first time I saw that, I thought, I don't usually get love from somebody I don't even know. But over the weeks and then months and now years that I've been reading your newsletter, I sort of get it. How did you decide to sign it love?
Well, at first it was just my people, like my students, like the people I, like, at the time, like, really cared about and knew. Yeah, and I just have continued to do it to show some level of humanity in these, in the science, to show that I care. Andy Slavitt, actually, in the height of the pandemic, asked me why I write love. And I was like, I probably should take it out. And he's like, "No, don't take it out. Like, it's just part of the style and the brand." And yeah, maybe it's a little unprofessional, I don't know, but it's just kind of where it's always been, and I want to keep it that way too. So it'll always probably be like that. Yeah.
Well, now I get the California YLE from Matt Willis.
Does he write love?
He writes love.
There you go.
Yeah.
See?
Okay. Well, we have a lot of public health people in the audience.
Yeah.
This is a big transition in your career. This academic to entrepreneurial public health, if you will, communication. Can you reflect on that in terms of that transition, for how it was for you and what perhaps people might want to take from that?
Yeah, you know, I was in academia and I always thought I was going to be in academia. I thought I was going to be working there until I was 80, a lot like my grandparents did. And I truly loved it. I truly loved teaching. I love the energy. I love the innovation. I love the autonomy. I love trying to build and answer questions and a place to think. But when the pandemic hit, I mean, it was all hands on deck. I mean, it didn't matter if you're an epidemiologist in academia or the health department. I mean, it was, everyone was going towards helping. And I started this newsletter. And, you know, at first, the academic institution very much supported it. I was giving a service to the community. But then as the pandemic went on, as the months and years went on, there was definitely a conversation of, "Caitlin, you need to focus on research grants. You need to focus on committees, all the committees we had to be on, and a lot of the teaching." you know, I was going up for tenure and putting together this CV, and my, you know, I was trying to figure out where to put my newsletter. Where do you put something that reached, by that time, I think it was like 350 million people. And what ended up happening was it was just a bullet point under community service on my CV. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I had to make a really hard decision. I had to decide whether to take an incredible leap and risk and leave academia, which was incredibly scary to me, to really focus on the newsletter and building that community, or to stay in academia. That was basically my two decision, or my two choices. And so, you know, I talked to a lot of mentors in academia. All of my mentors in academia said, don't do it. Mm-hmm. Like, you can never come back to academia. I was told there's nothing better out there. You know, it was very scary to make the move, but I ultimately decided to make that trust jump, that I had to trust myself that I was capable of finding a different job and creating a pathway forward, even if it was innovative and even if it was very much out of the box of what I was expected to do or what I always expected myself to do. In between that jump, because I couldn't jump all the way, I was like, I need a safety net or something. I went and worked in policy at a policy research tank, and then worked as well at the CDC and the White House during the COVID response, and then finally decided to go all in on my own company. And my company is a for-profit, and so I've kind of had like experience in academia, in government, and also in the for-profit space, and I have learned all of them have pros and cons. I have learned that there is no perfect place. It's all about where you are in the moment in life and how you want to spend your time, too.
But you have come back to academia a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I miss students and I miss teaching. And so, yeah, now I'm an adjunct professor at the Yale School of Public Health under Megan Rainey over at the School of Public Health. I'm teaching in spring, so I'll be flying to Connecticut quite often. You know, really thinking through how to innovatively integrate communication and translation as a core competency in public health, in a public health school. Because this hasn't been done, and so I really respect Megan's, Dean Rainey's vision of the need for that and the creativity and thinking outside of the box. And that is something that I didn't really find at my institution back at in Texas. And so I'm honored to, explore that and see what it looks like.
So let's see, you went from a red state and you're living in a blue state, and you're working in a blue state. Does that say anything there?
I will say, So I grew up in California, Southern California, and then I went to undergrad in Arizona and then graduate school in Texas, and I met a Texan, and it's hard to get a Texan out of Texas, so I was there for a while. And I will say I am so, so, so thankful that I was helping lead the response in a red state during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because it taught me and it forced me to learn how to listen. It forced me and taught me to learn about policy, that it's beyond scientific evidence, that it has a lot to do with values and psychology and culture of a place. And I think it made me a very balanced epidemiologist, and I will always look back and be thankful at that. Now I get to be back home, but you know, it was really good for me to be out there and doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, you wrote a newsletter. One of your newsletters was on values and how to combine that with data. Found that really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is going to sound silly, but like one of the lessons I learned during the pandemic was that, like I said, like policy is not based on only scientific information, right? It's based on all of these different factors. Like, I think we can all agree that we want evidence-informed policy. I think that's why I'm in public health in the first place. Mm-hmm. But there is values that are definitely added onto that. What the decisions we made in Texas were definitely not the decisions that were made in California. And I think part of that is because of the value systems were just so different and the priorities were so different. And I think that's okay too. And when we were writing that piece, it was really a look back of mistakes that we made, but also like reflection around the pandemic, something that I think us as a field, as a country, as states haven't done well enough. And one of the reasons I think that we lost so much trust during the pandemic was vaccine mandates. We had people, you know, it was either get vaccinated or lose their job. And so these value systems started getting mixed up with the scientific evidence. And it was really quite detrimental to a lot of the trust, a lot of the understanding of what science is, what policy is, and I think a reflection, a lesson that I learned is that when we talk about data, we have to be very clear of when we're talking about the data and the science and when we're adding our value system on top of that. And, you know, I'm not perfect in that, even right now. I try to be, but it is something that I still try to strive for so you don't lose people along the way.
Earlier, you were talking about government and academia and private work. And you were, last night when we were at dinner, you mentioned that there are a lot of things you could do in the private field that government couldn't do. Could you dilate on that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I think, like I said, there's pros and cons everywhere. Pros and cons, I mean, a lot of pros to academia. There was also cons in academia. It's slower, and for a good reason. You know, you need to do science in a very evidence, you know, steady thinking way. Government or policy, I am obsessed with policy. Like, if I had a dream job, it would be a policy advisor of the White House. Like, I think it is the coolest thing because it is so messy, and it's like a game of chess. But, you know, and it's so impactful. Like, I remember at the height of the pandemic, I was helping with the response in Houston, and we could just, we had so many resources, and you could see by us deploying Ubers to get vaccines into neighborhoods, it was directly starting to impact the numbers. I mean, it was pretty insane to watch policy have such a profound impact on population health. There are limitations to government, though. I went to the CDC. Rochelle Walensky called me one day, and I thought it was like a joke. Like, I thought it was a prank. I was like, how do you even get my cell phone? But she was like, hey, can you come help us over at CDC and, you know, try to be better communicators, try to fix the systems, try to be more responsive to the needs on the ground. And so I went into CDC. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to fix it all. Like, I got it. I have all the answers. And then you, like, I get there and, like, it explained, I learned so much because it explained why things were done during the pandemic and what the limitations are of government. Politics is such a huge factor in CDC culture. Right, the need to change culture within systems is incredibly challenging to do. The systems themselves need to be reimagined and reinvigorated. And I soon learned that, at least in communication, there's this huge gap that needs to be filled outside of government. That was like my big takeaway out of the CDC work. It was like, okay, you guys can try to do this, but your clearance processes, like every culture, blah, 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 like, there needs to be a far more agile system outside of government. And so after that work, I very much decided deliberately to start trying to build a system outside of government for that. One that is very fast, one that it doesn't matter about politics, one that is flexible and can breathe during emergencies versus during peacetime, one that can be hyper-local, one that listens from the bottom up and uses that sort of data. And so, I mean, there's pros and cons to that too. I mean, there's definitely cons to for-profit, like burnout, right? And like doing this so quickly. But I truly do believe that there is huge value in public-private partnerships. And that is something that I've tried to really lean into after lessons learned during the pandemic.
So you mentioned Rochelle Walensky. She's gone. Has RFK Jr. contacted you about?
He hasn't called me yet. I was definitely dozed in February by Elon Musk.
How so?
I was told the night before that, Caitlin, your contract is ending in the morning. And that was it. I wasn't surprised. I was in the director's office. Like, it's not like I'm good at shutting up. Like, you know, like I'm definitely a talker out there too. So, I don't think it was a surprise, but you know, it's a bummer because we were doing some really cool work with Mandy Cohen. She was such a different thinker. You know, Rochelle or Dr. Walensky was so good at infectious diseases, like, and she was so knowledgeable around disease and all of that. What Dr. Cohen was a different sort of thinker, and she's more operational. And I truly think that is what CDC needed was operational changes, and so we started doing some really cool work, and now it's very much dismantled, but we were starting to get there, and it's a really big bummer to really see that work crumble.
I get it. I think we all do. You mentioned culture. We hear often from the administration about changing the culture. I never really understand when people say that, what that actually means. What do you mean, or what goes through your mind when you think about changing the culture of an institution like CDC or CDPH, for example?
Yeah, I'll talk about CDC. I'm not very familiar with CDPH culture, but, you know, oh my God, where do I start? So there at CDC, there are definitely really fantastic comms teams. There's also incredibly brilliant scientists. The problem is the bridge between them is just not there. Or if it's there, it's incredibly broken. And the reason it's broken is because of lack of respect towards each other. A lot of scientists do not get why communicating public health is important. I talked about it last night where the worst thing, something worse than death threats that I get is thousands of paper cuts from colleagues. Mm-hmm. There's also a lack of knowledge between the need of, and then also comms peoples don't really respect what scientists do. And so there's this battle of this like tug of war between the two. And I found myself always in the middle between this tug of war between the two. I'm like, okay, you're right too. Like, let's find the middle, like, and keep going. I think there's that. I think the second really big problem at CDC was that there are really deep vertical pockets at CDC of scientific knowledge, right? You have the flu team, and then you have MPOX, and then you have, I don't know, like, parasites or whatever. You know, like, you have all these deep vertical pockets. The problem is that there's no bridges between those pockets of operations and of comms and of data and of emergency response. And so usually one group doesn't want to share lessons learned with another group. It's very territorial. The other thing that is very much culture that's, you know, challenging at CDC is that it's very death by democracy. there was, you would get into these meetings of like 70 people and then like no decision is made because no one wanted to make a decision. And so, I don't know, you know, there's just a lot of times we just got, it just got stuck. And I think we need to figure out how to unstick people. We need to figure out how to empower them. I think we need to think through how do we elevate new blood and new ideas and new innovations. I think it's how do we organize institutions to be more agile, to be more fast. And a lot of people don't want to change. They're very comfortable and didn't want to change, didn't see the need to change. And it can be hard to work in.
For sure. Speaking of change, I began by talking about those first few months of the pandemic. And I think one of the most difficult things for me was that we didn't know much about SARS-CoV-2. We didn't understand how it was transmitted. We made a lot of assumptions. We didn't have a real playbook for how to protect people, what they could do. We didn't have a vaccine at that point. We didn't have a drug. And we were giving lots of advice. And we had to be, we talking about medicine, public health, had to be the authoritative voice, but we weren't standing on a real firm foundation.
Yeah.
What do we do in that circumstance? I mean, I think about airborne transmission. I was using in my mind at the beginning of the pandemic the model of influenza, which is primarily large and medium-sized droplets. Art Reingold and I go back and forth about influenza all the time in terms of how it's transmitted. And that's from that came the 6-foot rule or 2-meter rule. And everybody was carrying out what we were saying, yet we were absolutely wrong about how it was transmitted. A couple of questions for you out of that is one, how do we give advice when we don't know a lot at the beginning of a pandemic? And I'll save my second one for after you answer that
one. Yeah, I think that when I look back, what I wish happened more of was communicating uncertainty. Was, you know, one rule or framework I always try to use is what do you know, what do you not know, and how are you finding answers? And that is not how things were communicated in the beginning. No. And there was also not a lot of honesty behind the answers too. You know, I think that there's a lot of policy decisions made, not necessarily about the science, but also about the environment and what was needed. I mean, I look back at masks saying we didn't need masks in March of 2020, but that's not necessarily because the science wasn't saying it. It was because our healthcare workers needed PPE, and people were very scared of people going running out and getting masks and when the hospitals needed it. There's a lot of other examples of policy throughout the pandemic where it wasn't necessarily made because of the science, but it was because of the situation and the landscape as well. And I think we need to be a whole lot more honest around trade-offs and around how we come to policy decisions and not always blaming it on the science or always like that's just how it is. I think one of the biggest lessons I learned during the pandemic was never underestimate the public, that they may not know, but they deserve to know and they want to know. They should be treated as adults too. And so, you know, I think that the uncertainty is what needs to really be communicated better. We were talking about this at dinner as well. Like the other thing that I wish we communicated better was risk. Risk communication, the typical formula is, you know, risk equals outrage times harm. And we really needed to not only meet the outrage and the fear, but also really talk through what the harm was as well. Risk communication is incredibly challenging. It's really hard. But I think that we need to figure out models and ways to make that a very big priority during any emergency. I think we also need to adapt a whole lot faster. I mean, you brought up the aerosolized. I mean, we had a pretty darn good idea that it was airborne in, and now I'm like all blacked out from the pandemic, but maybe like June of 2020.
Before that.
Yeah. And then it took WHO and CDC to update their guidelines like a year later. Mm-hmm. Like that is just unacceptable. And I think we really need to think through why it took that long and really try to dissect that. And again, it comes with speed and it comes with being okay with uncertainty, but bring people along for the ride. I mean, yeah, I remember in like, what was it, May, the 100 scientists wrote to CDC and WHO and still there was not much there. And so not much action taken. And I think that was also a very big mistake.
Right. Yeah. I remember that, I think it was in April, folks right here up at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, physicists in airborne particles. I met with them. They were very incensed with what was being promoted right at the beginning of the pandemic. They said, why aren't people talking about aerosolized? And they were amongst the, I think it was 200.
200,
scientists.
Okay.
Yeah,
200.
Scientists who wrote about that. Yeah, and that probably cost a lot of lives too.
Cost a lot of lives, and then it costs trust too. Like we're still 6 feet apart at Disneyland lines a year later, and it's like it's really not equipping people to make evidence-based decisions. And it was disappointing.
I think, at least in my mind, there was always the concern that if you tell the public that you don't know anything, or you don't know. Not anything, you know a lot, but you just don't know the answer to that. That there's the fear that that's going to create a more panicked public.
I just have the complete opposite experience. And maybe that was because I wasn't at the government. I don't know why, but in my newsletter, I mean, 99% of the time when you say you don't know, you actually increase trust more. Because people realize where your knowledge stops or where it begins and then where it stops. And we don't know everything. I mean, I think that's just the reality of it, too. We're all humans. I think we're trained as scientists and physicians to be like, we are the experts. We should know everything. But the truth is we just don't know everything. But what is important about that is not of we don't know, but I am going to go try to find the answer for you. And we are going to try to find that answer as quickly as possible. And when I find that answer, I am coming back to you. And you start doing that over and over and over again, and people start appreciating it. Especially during, you know, an emergency, and especially when things are going 2,000 miles per hour, and especially when you just don't know. Like, sure, you're going to get lucky, but then you're not going to get lucky, and you're just going to be flat out wrong. And that is what really starts hurting trust.
I'm smiling because reflecting back on my career of taking care of patients, I became very comfortable very early on in my career in terms of telling people exactly what I knew and what I didn't know and the limits of what I understood. And I worried initially that would that make my patient feel less secure? And I had the same experience that you were just saying, and that is that made them more confident in that they were part of a team and I was going to go and try and help them as best I could.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. And I think that was a big mistake that was made in general by all of us, including myself early on. Early on, as opposed to midway through the pandemic, as opposed to now, the game rules have changed tremendously. The virus has changed, how we respond to it has changed, and so on. Yet I've heard people so critical of the people trying to guide us through this. Let's take Tony Fauci, for example. People so critical of him. When in the first 9-12 months of the pandemic, it was a very different pandemic than it was after the vaccine became available, and decisions that we made were very different. Yet Fauci has certainly been, by so many people in this country, I think unfairly, personal opinion, demonized for making mistakes, and he certainly made mistakes. How do you communicate in your newsletter this idea of that one of the dynamic things about the pandemic is it's changed consistently over 5.5 years now?
You know, I one of the things that I've tried to do is bring people along for the ride. And, you know, that means not always like debunking or, you know, chasing falsehoods, but telling people where we are in the process, where I expect that we should be going, what my guesses are, and circling back. I think the other thing that, you know, so yeah, like bring, like being proactive and being like, hey, I think this is gonna, you know, we're gonna have another COVID wave in winter. It's probably coming. And then, you know, really just help people anticipate what is coming. One of the things that I cannot believe we got wrong was, you know, it took us 9 months to make a COVID vaccine, which was incredible, the speed that we were able to do that. What we did not do, though, was help people anticipate concerns, confusion, and questions that people had. And then the vaccine came available in December of 2020, and a lot of people were surprised when many people didn't line up to get the vaccine because they had questions and because they had concerns. And we didn't do a lot of the behavioral science aspect mm-hmm. of this. We were only focused on the bench science and the virology and the immunology when we have an entire knowledge base around behavioral science too. So I try to do that too and anticipate, right? Fall is coming in August. I'm like, here are your vaccine options for this fall. Like, this is what you can expect. We still have questions given what's happening at the federal level. I'll bring you along for the ride. The other thing is admitting when you're wrong. And this is something that I tried to do in my newsletter multiple times. And I wish more people would do is admitting when you're wrong and when you just got it flat out wrong. And I think that builds not trust. It just makes you more trustworthy. I think it makes you more human, and I think people appreciate that as well. So,
and I appreciate that in your newsletter, and I do recognize that for a lot of people. A lot of people in authority, including Fauci, had a tough time with that, at least in some of the aspects.
You know, it's hard because, like, I don't know, people are, like, sending us death threats, right? Like, why? Right. And so it's really hard to, like, put down your shield and admit that you're wrong. But I do think that is... has been a way that I've at least tried to lead in that moment. But it's hard. It is hard. It is humbling. It is a risk on safety, like quite frankly. You're putting your neck out there. And that's always very hard to do.
Earlier, you were talking about the CDC and other public health organizations and how devastating this current administration has been to public health. Yet you said something, I think it was at dinner or either in your talk, I think it was at dinner.
I had drinks last night. let's see what
I wasn't going to talk about that.
Okay.
But maybe it was before your drinks, but you said something that I really paid attention to, and that was there was a tone of optimism in your voice. It was more the tone than exactly the words, but the words had something to do with that this is an incredible opportunity for public health. And I must say that it's a dark time right now, as we all would acknowledge, and it's sometimes hard to see what an opportunity this is. But I'd like you to tell me and the audience more about what you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that this is an incredibly dark time in public health. There's certainly a X on our backs, and our systems are getting dismantled by the minute, and there's soon going to be rubble all around the floor. I think, though, the way I'm at least looking at it is that there will be opportunity to reimagine our systems, And there's going to be opportunity to not just rebuild what we had, but make public health for the 21st century and whatever that looks at. And not only public health, but imagining how the health ecosystem can work together and integrate for Americans to be healthier. And I, you know, and so I think one of the biggest frustrations I have in this moment is they are completely dismantling public health without like a vision on how to make it better. And that's what I get really frustrated about. But eventually we'll be able to do that. And I hope that the brightest, most innovative, multidisciplinary minds are at the table to really start thinking what the federal government can do for Americans and what that looks like. I just haven't seen it happen yet, but I think we'll get there. The other thing is, like, you just need hope, too, like, to keep going. I've really tried to hold on to that, to continue writing my newsletter, but also as a mom with two little kids and as a community member to keep going. So maybe it's false hope, but that's where I'm at right now.
I don't think it's false hope. You know, I think it's real hope. And your newsletter has really, I think, helped a lot of people, not just public health people, physicians. I think a lot of the lay public have hope. I'd like to just to ask a couple more questions and turn questions over to the audience. But in your newsletter, you really speak to a variety of different audiences. How do you know who you want to speak to? How do you get statistics on what you do, or do you get statistics on what the audience is? And can you tell us a little bit about the nuts and bolts of your newsletter in terms of?
Yeah, so at first I thought I was always talking to Joe on the corner. Like at the beginning of the pandemic, I'm like, oh my gosh, I am going straight into the household and changing minds. And I was like so excited about that. And then I did a survey because I'm an epidemiologist. I'm like, okay, who am I actually talking to? And I did that survey, my first survey, I think in 2021, and 77,000 people answered that survey. And what I discovered very quickly was it was not Joe on the corner. About 70% of the audience is MDs, PhDs, or master's degrees. So very highly educated, right? That is not reflective of the general population. The other really interesting thing is I collected, I asked about employment. And what I also discovered was that who I was talking to, and this completely changed my worldview, was I was talking to trusted messengers. I was talking to pastors. I was talking to education boards, to physicians, to policymakers, to school nurses. And what that realization kind of gave me was that YLE is this node in this massive grassroots information diffusion system where you have all of these trusted messengers that then communicate to their audience, and those communicate to their audience. And so eventually it reaches the households, but you have to figure out where those nodes are and equip them to do it easily, to do it easier. So, for example, the chief financial officer of this international bank is one of my followers, and what he does is puts sometimes YLE content in the front of his stock reports that he emails to his 100,000 employees. And so you start seeing this like network effect. And so that really changed how I started communicating, right? Like I didn't need to explain to my audience that mRNA is not DNA, but rather like how can I help these trusted messengers more easily, one, understand what's going on, but also to communicate to their networks. How can I make it as easy as possible for them to do that? So I still do a yearly survey. It hasn't changed much, the audience. And then we also have statistics. I mean, every newsletter you have statistics of like opens and where they are and like, I don't know, all the data, which as a data nerd, I love, but you know, I think it's so important when you're communicating to understand who your audience is. and how you can help them and who you want to reach too is definitely depends on how you talk and how you communicate. And I think that is part of the secret sauce of communicating, right? Like when I have breakfast, so for example, with Senator Cassidy, like I said last night, I use very different words than if I'm talking to my sister or I'm talking to Governor Newsom, right? And so the words we use matter, the values that are reflected by those words really matter if you truly want to get that message across and, more importantly, equip people out there to make evidence-based decisions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.